That's right. The Ringworld is immune to the core explosion. When did you figure this out?
Just now. I had placed the core some time ago.
You'd get some scattering, heavy radiation around the rim walls.
But the luck of Teela Brown would place her away from the rim walls when the wave front arrives.
20,000 years. Louis was appalled. Finnegal's bright smile, how can anyone think in such terms?
Sickness and death are always bad luck, Louis. By our assumptions, Teela Brown should live forever.
But, right, she's not thinking in those terms. It's her luck, hovering over us all like a puppet master.
Nessus had been a corpse at room temperature for 2 months now. He did not decay. The lights on his first aid kit remained alight and even changed on occasion. It was his only sign of life. Louis was gazing at the puppeteer, minutes later, when two thoughts rubbed together.
Puppeteer, he said softly.
Louis?
I just wondered if the puppeteers didn't get their name by playing God with the species around them. They've treated humans in Kazinti like puppets, there's no denying that.
But Teela's luck made a puppet of Nessus.
We've all been playing God at various levels.
Louis nodded at Prill, who was catching perhaps every third word.
Prill and you and me. How did it feel, Speaker? Were you a good god or a bad one?
I cannot know. The species was not my own, though I have studied humans extensively. I stopped a war, you will remember. I pointed out to each side that it must lose. That had been 3 weeks ago.
Yeah, my idea.
Of course.
Now you'll have to play God again.
To Kazinti, said Louis.
I do not understand.
Nessus and the other puppeteers have been playing planned breeding games on humans in Kazinti. They deliberately brought about a situation in which natural selection would favor a peaceable Kazin, right?
Yes.
What would happen if the Patriarch learned of this?
War, said the Kazin. A heavily provisioned fleet would attack the puppeteer worlds after a 2-year flight. Perhaps humanity would join us. Surely the puppeteers have insulted you as badly.
Surely they have. And then?
Then the leaf-eaters would exterminate my species down to the last kitten. Louis, I do not intend to tell anybody anything concerning starseed lures and puppeteer breeding plans. Can I persuade you to keep silence?
Right.
Is this what you meant by playing God to my species?
That and one more thing, said Louis. The long shot. Do you still want to steal it?
Perhaps, said the Kazin.
You can't do it, said Louis, but let's assume you could. Then what?
Then the Patriarchy would have the second quantum hyperdrive.
And?
Prill seemed to be aware that something crucial was happening. She watched them as if ready to stop a fight.
Soon we would have warships capable of crossing a light year in 1¼ minutes. We would dominate known space and slave every species within our reach.
And then?
Then it ends. This is precisely our ambition, Louis.
No. You'd keep conquering. With a drive that good, you'd move outward in all directions, spreading thin, taking every world you found. You'd conquer more than you could hold. And in all that expanded space, you'd find something really dangerous. The puppeteer fleet. Another ring world, but at the height of its power. Another slaver race, just starting its expansion. Bandersnatchy with hands, Grogs with feet, Cadet Lino with guns.
Scare images.
You've seen the ring world. You've seen the puppeteer worlds. There must be more in the space you could reach with the puppeteer hyperdrive.
The Kazin was silent.
Take your time, said Louis. Think it through. You can't take the long shot anyway. You'd kill us all if you tried it.
The next day, the improbable crossed a long, straight, meteoric furrow. They turned to anti-spinward, directly toward Fist of God. Fist of God Mountain had grown large without coming near. Bigger than any asteroid, roughly conical, she had the look of a snow-capped mountain swollen to nightmare size. The nightmare continued, for Fist of God continued to swell.
"I don't understand," said Prill.
She was puzzled and upset.
"This formation is not known to me. Why was it built? At the rim there are mountains as high, as decorative and more useful, for they hold back the air."
"That's what I thought," Louis Wu said, and he would say no more. That day they saw a small glass bottle resting at the edge of the meteoric gouge they had been following. The lyre was as they had left it, on its back, on a frictionless surface. Mentally, Louis postponed the celebration. They were not home yet. In the end, Prill had to hover the improbable so that Louis could cross from the landing ramp. He found controls that would open both doors of the airlock at the same time. But air murmured out around them all the time they were transferring Nessus's body. They could not reduce the cabin pressure without Nessus, and Nessus was, to all appearances, dead. But they got him into the auto dock anyway. It was a puppeteer-shaped coffin, form-fitted to Nessus himself and bulky. Puppeteer surgeons and mechanics must have intended that it should handle any conceivable circumstance. But had they thought of decapitation? They had. There were two heads in there, and two more with necks attached, and enough organs and body parts to make several complete puppeteers. Grown from Nessus himself, probably. The faces on the heads looked familiar. Prill came aboard and landed on her head. Rarely had Louis seen anyone so startled. He'd never thought to tell her about induced gravity. Her face showed nothing as she stood up, but her posture... she was awed to silence. In that ghostly silence of homecoming, Louis Wu suddenly screamed like a banshee.
"Coffee!" he yelled.
"And hot water!" He charged into the stateroom he had shared with Teela Brown. A moment later, he put his head out and screamed, "Prill?" Prill went. She hated coffee. She thought Louis must be insane to swallow the bitter stuff, and she told him so. The shower was a long-lost, badly missed luxury, once Louis explained the controls. She went wild over the sleeping plates. Speaker was celebrating the homecoming in his own fashion. Louis didn't know everything about the Kazin's stateroom. He did know that the Kazin was eating his head off.
"Meat!" Speaker exulted. "I was not happy eating long-dead meat."
"That stuff you're eating now is reconstituted."
"Yes, but it tastes freshly killed."
That night, Prill retired to a couch in the lounge. She appreciated the sleeping field, but not for sleeping. But Louis Wu slept in freefall for the first time in 3 months. He slept 10 hours and woke feeling like a tiger. A half disk of sun flamed beneath his feet. Back aboard the Improbable, he used the flashlight laser to free the knobbed end of the shadow square. When he finished, it still had some fused electrosetting plastic attached. He did not try to carry it to the lyre. The black thread was far too dangerous, the ring floor far too slippery. Louis moved on all fours on the frictionless surface, and he pulled the knob behind him. He found Speaker silently watching from the airlock. Louis entered the airlock via Prill's stepladder, pushed past the Kazin and went aft. Speaker continued to watch. The farthest point aft in the wreck of the lyre was a channel the size of a man's thigh. It had passed wiring to machinery in the lyre's wing when the lyre had had a wing. Now it was sealed by a metal hatch. Louis opened the hatch, tossed the knob end of the wire through and outside. He moved forward. At intervals, he checked the position of the wire by using it to slice a Jinxian sausage dialed from the lyre's kitchen. Then he marked the spot with bright yellow paint. When he finished, the path of the virtually invisible thread was marked in a line of yellow splotches running through the lyre. When the wire drew taut, it would certainly cut through some internal partitions of the ship. The yellow paint allowed Louis to gauge the path it would take and to assure himself that the wire would not damage any part of the life support system. But the paint had another purpose. It would warn them all to keep away from the wire lest they lose fingers, or worse. Louis left the airlock, waited for Speaker to follow him out. Then he closed the outer door. At this point, Speaker asked,
"Is this why we came?"
Tell you in a minute, said Louis. He walked aft along the general product's hull, picked up the knob in both hands, and tugged gently. The wire held. He put his back into it. He pulled with all his strength. The wire did not budge. The airlock door held it fast.